Today is Tuesday, November 5th. We're going to start on 107 with the nerve anatomy. All right, so what's found there on this, pictured on page 107 should look a little bit familiar. In fact, that should look a lot like what you've got on a muscle picture. I'm just going to let you guys read through that because largely page 107 is a rerun for you, and then we're going to move on to 108. So you'll notice the terms epineurium, perineurium, and endoneurium there on page 107. And exactly the same way the muscle is constructed, we find those same membranous coverings on our nerves. So where would you expect to find your epineurium? Yeah, that top line on the left. Yeah, that is your epineurium. Covers the outside. This picture's not right. Okay, so covering the top outside is epineurium. What type of neurium wraps a fascicle of nerve fibers? Perineurium. Good. That's that bottom left arrow. And then following suit with our muscle anatomy, where would you find the endoneurium? Endoneurium's that right-hand arrow that covers an individual nerve fiber.
Are we on page 106?
I've got 107. You guys have 106?
Yeah.
Okay, so depends on what, I guess, version you've got. We're going to probably be a page off for the remainder of the semester. So if you've got a nerve that looks like that, that's where we are. Okay. And just want to draw your attention to the bottom of the page there. Tracts, nerves, ganglia are all terms that refer to collections of nerves. And let me specify that a tract is specifically within the CNS. So when you hear about the word olfactory tract or optic tract, that should ring a bell that says, hey, this is part of our brain. It's part of the central nervous system. Ascending tracts, we just got through talking about those. That's another bell that should ring for us. Those are, again, in your central nervous system. When we use the term nerve or ganglion, that is a reference to a peripheral nervous system. So when we say optic nerve, we are implying that we are outside the central nervous system. When we talk about spinal nerve or cranial nerve, like we just did on the board there, we're talking about, again, peripheral nervous system, outside that central nervous system. All right, so any questions on that nerve anatomy or those terms? Okay, so your next page, I've got 108. Some of you may have 107. It is this picture here of the spinal nerve and ramus. Okay, so first off, what you're looking at is basically the picture we had on the board. It is a cross-section of your spinal cord with some spinal nerves coming off. And what we did on the board was we stopped where that spinal nerve emerged from your vertebral column. Now, in this picture, you'll notice they take us a little step further. In fact, right here, when you emerge from the intervertebral foramen, that spinal nerve immediately branches off into, yet again, mixed nerves. These branches are called ramus. Or plural, they're called rami. Okay, so a branch of a spinal nerve is called a ramus, just like the word arm. And in this picture, you can actually see some of those branches coming off. Some of those branches travel around to the back of your body, and they're called dorsal rami. So, for instance, where is latissimus dorsi located? Your back, right. There are branches of your spinal nerve that serve the latissimus dorsi. They're going to be dorsal rami. They're back branches of those spinal nerves. Where is, say, pectoralis major located? Chest muscles, right? So there are ventral rami that branch off and serve the front side of your body. So anything on the front side of your body will be served by ventral branches of spinal nerves. They're called ventral rami. Anything that's on the back side of your body is going to be served by dorsal rami. And so here's what I was talking about. Some of those back muscles are served by the dorsal branches up here in yellow. And then these yellow branches coming here toward the front are served by those ventral rami. So something interesting to note here. The body is set up divided in half along the midline. Okay, so back here is the spinal column, spinal cord. And on one side, you have a set of dorsal rami and ventral rami. And of course, the other side is served by another set of dorsal and ventral rami. I make that point because if there's damage to, say, the right latissimus dorsi, then it's the right side of your spinal cord and those branches that would be serving that area. So that's where we would look for problems. So if you've got a herniated disc, then it's going to be on this side affecting the same side of the body. Likewise, if you have problems with the ventral rami, then we take, pathway from the spinal cord and we follow it around. So there's none of this contralateral control stuff like we talked about a little bit with the spinal column. It is basically as you see it. If you have problems with nerves on the left side, it is left side nerves serving that area, and vice versa, right side is affected by nerves branching off the right side of your spinal column. Does that make sense? Okay. The reason I mention that is because of the next thing called a dermatome. Down near the bottom of your page, you'll notice this map of the body. These lines on the body are actually served by spinal nerves. So we can say, hey, you've got pain on this particular region of your body. Maybe it's skin or maybe it's muscle. We know that there is a particular spinal nerve that serves that particular region of your body. And we can trace it back and perhaps find there's a problem with your spinal cord or perhaps a bulging or a herniated disc. So interesting, you can see up here in green, that top part is cervical spinal nerves. The top part of your neck serves the head and the arms. The bluish color there is thoracic spinal nerves. It covers most of your abdomen and chest area. Down lower back, as you would expect, what kind of spinal nerves serve lower back? Lumbar is good. And then once we get down toward sacral, butt crack area, right? Sacral spinal nerves serve the back side of your body. And notice the lumbar serve the front side of your body. So anyone who has numbness, pain, tingling, muscle issues down the back side, we're looking at sacral spinal nerves, those lower ones that come off the very tail portion of your spinal column, but the front ones are actually served by lumbars. So you should not expect to have sciatic nerve problems affecting the front of your legs because sciatic nerve branches off this sacral bunch on the back. So kind of cool that you can look at this and figure out what part of the body is affected by what set of spinal nerves. All right, so this map that you're looking at, both the one on the left and here on the right, these are called dermatomes, and it's basically where the skin and muscles are innervated and served by a set of spinal nerves. So kind of a cool thing for us to look at there. So I wanted to share with you some pictures of how those spinal nerves work. For instance, if you've got, say, herpes virus or shingles virus or varicella, which is chicken pox, they tend to inflame the nerve starting at your back. So let me go back to this picture. When you have, say, a virus like herpes, shingles, varicella, all those, very similar, they will start their inflammation back here along the spinal cord, and then they will pick one of these spinal nerve rami, and they will travel and follow that particular ramus. Notice when it gets to the sternum, that is the end of that spinal nerve. Can we then continue across the sternum and hit the other side? We can't. It doesn't work that way. So for you to inflame the other side, you would have had to start at the back and travel that ventral ramus around and hit here at the sternum. So there is no fear of having it like literally wrap you from back to front and then skip over the midline and keep on going. It just doesn't work that way. So these are pretty specific inflammations along one particular spinal nerve. So sometimes people have blisters or nerve pain. That's very hard to treat. And we have to wait for the nerve inflammation to go away in order for the skin blistering to go away. You can topically treat this, but ultimately it's the nerve that's causing the inflammation down below. So this is another good look. It's a very specific spinal nerve that's been served here with an inflammation. Here's more of these. They do travel a specific set of spinal nerves. They may only affect one side of the body, and they may not affect the other side, which is probably good news. You can see that spinal nerve affects the armpit area. This affects only one side of this person's face. And even worse here, you can see that affecting the eye. That's a pretty serious inflammation. And this is a really wild picture. This particular herpes infection only traveled a cranial nerve, same setup, on one side. So you can see right there at the midline that it stopped. So pretty wild. One side of that tongue hurt like heck. The other side probably felt okay. Okay, so if you were to use just a regular term to describe rhamnos, what would you say? Rhamnos means branch, right? Okay, so the word rhamnos, when you think of that, think just branch of a spinal nerve. And now we're going to take this a step further. If you'll flip on over with me. Okay, so to take this a step further, you'll notice the top of the next page has the term plexus written there. And a plexus is a network of branching spinal nerves. So we're still talking about branched spinal nerves, but now we're looking at a network. So let's just pick one of these in the picture and follow it. This looks like lumbar nerve number 3. Right here is your spinal nerve. It is mixed. It contains both sensory and motor information housed inside. And if we follow it, it looks like it branches. And part of that may come to the front and be a ventral rhamnos. And part of that branch may travel to the back and be say, a dorsal rhamnos. So if you follow just the clean branching lines, you know, you can kind of follow where the ventral and the dorsal branches or rami branch off. But if you look at it in comparison with all these other spinal nerves, they're all also branching. And not only that, but they crisscross. So watch how lumbar nerve number 3 comes off. Here's lumbar nerve number 2, and it actually meets up with number 3. And oh boy, here's number 4, and they all kind of come together. So these networks are called plexuses. Can you think of any reason they might be of a benefit to us? Fallback, yeah, great. It's a workaround if you have a severed nerve. What if you were to damage and cut L3? Could you still have a fairly functional nerve that travels out here? Yeah, because look who else is working it, right? L4 is contributing to that nerve, and L2 is contributing to that nerve. So you may lose some motor or sensory skills there, but you do have a workaround. You've kind of got a backup routing system here that still can manage either motor control over that area or bring sensory input from an area. So that is the great thing about a plexus. It is a workaround for any kind of damages that we may have, because if you were to cut L3 and that was the only innervation to a muscle, what would happen to your muscle? Paralysis, right. So that is the benefit of having these nerve plexuses set up the way that they are. So I'd like to share with you 5 of our most important nerve plexuses. All right, so the first one is called a cervical plexus. And as the name implies, where in the body would you find this one? In your neck, good. So what are the names of the nerves that emerge from the spinal cord in the neck area? They are cervical, good. So we have C1 through C8 in this area, and we're looking specifically at a set of nerves that emerge to form a breathing mechanism, and that's gonna be our phrenic nerve. So you'll notice the main ones involved here in the cervical plexus do not include all C1 through C8. In fact, we just include C1 through C5 in our cervical plexus. It is that group of nerves that gives rise to this phrenic nerve. And this is a very important nerve because it travels from your cervical area in your neck down to your diaphragm. What does it help control? Breathing, exactly. So any kind of damage to the neck area that impacts C1 through C5 can impair breathing. So, you know, whether somebody's hit here, has, you know, other damage that goes on in the neck on either side, that phrenic nerve is very important for breathing. So each side of your neck carries a phrenic nerve that goes to your diaphragm on the left or right side. Okay, so what to know here? I would know the phrenic nerve is our most important member of the cervical nerve plexus. And you'll notice what it's responsible for. It innervates or stimulates the diaphragm. That's important for our breathing. Here's a little cleaner look at that. So, and going back to this picture for just a moment, if somebody breaks and has major damage to the spinal cord at C7, can that person still breathe voluntarily? Yeah, because C1 through C5 are still controlling breathing. If, however, the damage to the spinal cord is done at C2 or C4, now you've got breathing problems, right? Because that's what is innervating that diaphragm, is that region of nerves there. All right, let's talk about the next setup. That one is brachial plexus. And the word brachial implies we're dealing with an arm plexus. So this plexus is actually going to emerge close to your spine there. It is in your armpit area, right there under the diaphragm, or sorry, right under the scapula. I'm still stuck on the last topic. So right here in the armpit area, you can see where this nerve set up emerges, and then these nerves travel down your arm all the way to the fingertips. So there's 5 main members of your brachial nerve plexus. On your worksheet, they are musculocutaneous. Guess what that one serves? Yeah, muscles and the skin, right? So musculocutaneous serves muscles and skin. The median nerve is here in your arm. Okay, and it will, of course, travel down and give rise to these ulnar and radial nerves. And if you follow to the hand, you've got a piece of a medial nerve here in the fingers in yellow. The ulnar nerve serves your pinky region, and the radial nerve serves your thumb region. So for anyone who has had carpal tunnel syndrome, you know, there's usually nerve entrapment that occurs in their wrist area, maybe due to the angle that you're operating a computer. And so if you have numbness in your pinky, we say, you've probably entrapped your ulnar nerve. Or if you've got more problems with your thumb, we say, well, you've probably entrapped your radial nerve. Okay, so wherever the damage is, we can typically trace it to one of those nerve setups. Axillary is the last one, and as the name implies, where do you think it's located? Yeah, it's up here in the armpit area. So it's not labeled here, but it is an armpit area nerve. Anyone who damages the brachial nerve plexus in a particular region can have any damage show up in muscle control from the armpit down. This is an axillary nerve damage here in this brachial nerve plexus because this person cannot raise his left arm like he can his right arm. So if you damage, say, only the radial or ulnar nerve, that's not going to control this deltoid muscle. So you might see the nerve damage show up further down toward the hand. So like we talked earlier, lumbar nerve plexus and sacral nerve plexus serve the lower back and the legs. One of them serves the front of your legs. That one is what? Lumbar. Yep. So the lower back muscles or lower back nerves and muscles all are controlled by that lumbar setup. They do serve the front of your leg. The back of your leg and the buttocks region are housed in the sacral nerve plexus. So that travels down the back of your leg. Now, let's talk about the important nerves here. The lumbar plexus is served by the femoral nerve. And how about the sacral nerve plexus? What is its most important member? Sciatic nerve.
Literally.
Yes, literally. All right, so here's lumbar plexus. You can see the lower lumbar spinal nerves emerging from the spinal cord there. Of course, we know around L1 or L2, we no longer have a spinal cord, and instead we have a horse's tail called what? Called a equina. So these branched endings here come up from that cauda equina region, and of course they do give rise to the femoral nerve. There you can see it coming down that leg on the front side. So like any good plexus, there's a network here. It just goes to show that there's not just one nerve giving rise and serving that leg area. There's a network of multitude of nerves serving that area. All right, so let's talk about sacral plexus on the backside. Let me zoom you in here. Deep in your backside, there is a tiny muscle called the piriformis muscle. This sits deep to your gluteus muscles. And this muscle has, right running through it or underneath it, that sciatic nerve, which branches off your sacral nerve plexus. That sciatic nerve can be pinched by your piriformis muscle. So yeah, literally, like you said, it's a pain in the butt, and it's caused by a muscle that can pinch around that nerve. So if you have, say, a female carrying a baby, that may be all you need to cause pain in that sciatic nerve, because it can pinch off that area from the weight of the baby sitting inside. So if you want to get rid of sciatic nerve pain, you oftentimes have to go to the source, and that is in the buttocks region. That's in that piriformis muscle area. We do know that sacral plexus is quite a network here. Lots of nerve branches coming off from those lower sacral nerves. And you can see that sciatic nerve is the main one serving the backside of your leg. All right, so if you have sciatic nerve pain, it may feel like a pinch in the butt muscle area or the buttocks. It may feel like numb, tingling, pins and needles running down the back of your thigh, the back of your calf, or even to your foot. So some people have a numb foot starting here with the heel area and not realize that the real problem is not a pain in the foot, but it's a pain in the butt. So that is what we ultimately have to look at, is if you've got numbness in the heel or foot area, where is it originating? And it's probably way back up here. So they call it piriformis syndrome. Thank you to that little piriformis muscle that can, there you go, can squeeze that sciatic nerve as it comes through. Ever had that? Oh yeah. If you have it, you're lucky, right? Because
don't want it, no.
Not a great picture here for the solar plexus. This one is actually housed behind your digestive organs. So if you were to move them out of the way, we would have this last major plexus. So this particular plexus, you'll notice, includes a couple of major nerves. One of them is called the splanchnic nerves and the vagus nerve. Splanchnic we'll talk about in Bio 211. This one actually serves like bladder. We'll leave that for urinary discussion, but the vagus nerve is one of our best, most important nerves to discuss. You'll notice what it serves. It serves the heart, lungs, digestive organs. In fact, here is a map of what it can innervate. That's massive. All right, so if someone is hit in this lower abdomen region, you know, right below the diaphragm, and that happens to stun that vagus nerve, look at all the organs that are going to be impacted by that. You know, you can alter breathing and heart rate. You can impact the movement of food through your digestive tract. So it's a major nerve that serves those areas. All right, and the interesting about the vagus nerve is, notice that it comes all the way up here from the brain. It is actually cranial nerve number 10. It is not a spinal nerve. So it's not a spinal nerve plexus. It's actually a cranial nerve that's serving these lower abdominal areas. So here's an interesting thought. If someone has spinal cord damage, even at C1, that can impair breathing because that impacts your phrenic nerve, right? But how is it someone can still have vital organ function even if spinal cord damage occurs at C1? There you go. Yep, cranial nerve 10, that's our vagus nerve. So if that is still intact, then it still has an innervation to all these muscles, or all these organs rather, heart, lungs, digestive organs, even the kidneys receive a vagus nerve innervation. So people may still have autonomic function, meaning automatic function, even if they don't have, it can be a quadriplegic. So very important nerve. You will hear lots about that when you go on to Bio 211. Do y'all have any questions on our five major nerve plexuses? You'll want to know the highlighted or the bold-faced term there, who's the major nerve in the nerve plexus and what that area is serving. So we've kind of talked about reflex arcs already. Let's hit them at the bottom of your page. All right, so reflexes are rapid, predictable, automatic, and involuntary. So can you stop a reflex? Nope. Can't stop the blinking. You can't stop the sneezing. In fact, if you stub your toe, you can't stop your body from jerking the toe back or the foot back from the area that you hit. So these reflexes are mostly rapid, automatic, predictable, and involuntary. I do want to mention, though, that some reflexes can be learned. Some, in fact, can be voluntarily learned. So if you type and you don't even have to look at where your fingers are, and you're doing it so fast that you're typing out words without your brain really having to be involved, that's actually a reflex. So a lot of our motor skills can be mapped as reflexes. You can train your body to learn a reflexive pathway without having to have your brain constantly be in control of whatever it is you're doing. But for the most part, they're rapid and automatic and involuntary. All right, so what you're looking at here is a reflex pathway. We've actually kind of covered this in a little bit. There's two major types of reflexes. They are in the box down below. One type is called a monosynaptic reflex, and the other one's called a polysynaptic reflex. All right, so first bullet point there says monosynaptic reflexes have sensory and motor neurons involved only. That means there's no interneurons in a monosynaptic pathway. What do polysynaptics have included? Yeah, they include an interneuron. So notice that major difference. Monosynapse means one synapse. That occurs between sensory and motor neurons only, whereas polysynaptic pathways are involving interneurons, so there may be more synapses in that particular pathway. So let me show you this example of a monosynaptic reflex. You'll notice in this picture we have a sensory neuron coming from a muscle. It's telling us what's happening with the muscle. It's basically a tattletale about what's going on. And that sensory neuron comes into your spinal cord and arrives first into that gray matter. I want you to notice, though, that we don't stop at the interneurons. They're housed in what horn? Dorsal, yeah. So we don't actually stop at the dorsal horn. We bypass it, and we come all the way down here to the ventral horn. What type of motor neurons are housed in the ventral horn? Voluntary. Yes, the skeletal muscle control, voluntary control of motor neurons there comes from that ventral horn of the gray matter. And the message is sent right back out to that muscle. So this is such a fast reflex because all we do is send sensory information in. We tell a motor neuron, and the motor neuron sends a nerve impulse right back out. This is a really fast pathway because there is one synapse. The synapse occurs between the sensory incoming neuron and what? Yeah, that outgoing motor. Notice there's no interneurons here. There's no time for talk or no time for communication. All we do is come in, zap the motor neuron sends a message back out. So you'll notice that stretch reflexes work this way. So if the muscle is sensed as being stretched by this sensory neuron up top, the nerve impulse comes in, hits that dorsal, or that ventral horn rather, skips the dorsal horn, and comes right back out with a message to the muscle telling it to contract. What might be a problem if you overstretch a muscle? Tear it, yeah. And what do you know about the healing time for torn skeletal muscle? Takes a long time, right? So it's not a good healer, it's a slow healer. So we don't want to tear skeletal muscle. That's why we need a reflex to ensure that if you're getting ready to tear skeletal muscle, you contract and that re-shortens that muscle back to a more normal state. So this is a reflex that's going to occur in muscles. You may not even know it's happening because it's a way to adjust us so that we don't overwork or overstretch those muscles. Let me give you a specific type of monosynaptic reflex, a different one called a knee-jerk reflex. And this knee-jerk reflex occurs when you strike your patellar ligament. Do you know where that patellar ligament is found? By the knee, good. So if you strike the patellar ligament there, you can actually initiate a monosynaptic reflex. Notice this branch here that doesn't stop at the dorsal horn, comes directly to the ventral horn, and the muscle that's innervated coming back out there is which one? What's on the front of your thigh? Quadriceps, right? Okay, so if you strike your patellar ligament, that sends an impulse into your spinal cord, right to a motor neuron that comes back out to your quadriceps. And what happens to your leg? Extends, right. So that is a way to make your muscle work without having to have your brain ever involved. So this message never goes to your brain. In fact, it shouldn't even have to go up your spinal cord for control. This message comes in your spinal cord and back out, and you've straightened your leg before you even have a chance to say, have any say-so over this process. So that is your blank there. The general pathway, we typically bypass your brain. Okay, so we typically bypass the brain. So stretch reflexes and knee-jerk reflexes are two great examples of a monosynaptic reflex. They're really fast because we have bypassed your brain. In fact, we have bypassed an interneuron, and that is your second blank, the part of your polysynaptic pathway that's missing for a monosynaptic pathway. That's an interneuron. So let's talk about polysynaptic reflex arcs. They also travel a similar pathway. Whatever the sensory information is that's coming in is carried to interneurons, and those interneurons can then send information down here to this dorsal horn. Why the dorsal horn? Well, what's in, incoming sensory here, and then we send it to this, ventral horn down at the bottom, and the ventral horn is housing what kind of motor neurons?
Voluntary,
good. So that's going to be skeletal muscle that we're innervating. We then can travel back out with nerve impulses that are motor in nature that tell us to move that body part. So this kind of reflex arc is a little more complex. A polysynaptic pathway includes interneurons, whereas a monosynaptic does not. It's still fast, it's just not as fast as a monosynaptic pathway. Okay, so touching your hand to a hot stove works this very same way. Let's map it out on the picture that we've got over here. All right, so if you touch a hot stove, we're gonna come with that information into this sensory root of our spinal nerve, and that sensory root, is it dorsal or ventral? It's dorsal. We travel into the spinal cord, and we hit which of these three horns? Hit the dorsal horn first. That contains interneurons. All right, so those interneurons say, okay, this is going to be a bad situation. You put your hand on a hot stove, and it sends the information out one of these other horns. Which one?
Voluntary.
Yeah, this one here that controls skeletal muscles. Even though your movement away is an involuntary action, we pick this pathway because we're innervating what kind of muscles? Skeletal. So the message now comes back out our ventral root here, comes out the spinal nerve, and it goes to those muscles that innervate your arm, and you flex your arm away from that pain source. So you jerk your hand away so fast that you don't even have time to process and think about it. So that's how a polysynaptic pathway works. This time we involve those interneurons in helping make this decision. But I also want to tell you what else happens. As you've jerked your hand away from that hot stove, those interneurons are also tattling on you. They send the information across the brain to the shoulder and over here to ascending tracts on the opposite side of your body. This is called contralateral control. Meaning what?
Opposite side.
Do you see any reason why we would travel up the opposite side of your spinal cord from the source of pain? Now, what if you damaged that whole side over there? There'd be no way to move, right? So if we come up the opposite side, then we're giving our bodies a chance to control the side that may receive damage, because we still have a pathway to and from the brain on the opposite side of the spinal cord. So which pathway do you think we're taking to the brain? Yeah, we're taking this one here, right? All right, and so that carries what type of information to the brain?
Pain and temperature.
Pain and temperature. So while you are reflexing in the spinal cord and back out with this message to move from the source of pain, your interneurons are also taking care of notifying your brain. And you know, if you've ever done this, you know, you put your hand on something hot, you jerk away, you say, oh gosh, that's gonna hurt. And a split second later, you then feel the pain, because that delay is you traveling up that ascending track all the way to the brain, to the thalamus, and to the correct portion of your brain surface. So it takes a moment for that pathway to follow. If you consciously decide to rinse your hand under cold water, you then come back down under descending tracks, and they're scattered in these white columns out here. So that motor control is in-housed in those descending tracks. So when you're talking about a monosynaptic reflex, you didn't involve interneurons, so there was no way for us to get the message to the brain simply over this ascending pathway. So the only way you can do it is if you've got a polysynaptic pathway that carries that message over to the ascending tracks and up to your brain. Okay, so let's do this one more time. All right, so monosynaptic means what two neurons are involved?
Sensory
and motor. And we do not include which type of neuron in this pathway?
Interneuron,
good. And this pathway is really fast, because all we do is come into your spinal cord and come right back out. We synapse if it's voluntary motor control with which of our three horns? If it's voluntary motor, hit that ventral horn. If it's involuntary and smooth muscle control, we hit the lateral. Yeah, so it just depends on what you're trying to control. By contrast, when you're talking about a polysynaptic pathway, we're talking about the involvement of what go-between neuron? Interneurons, good. And so this time you receive a message at the interneurons. You can then send motor information back out, and at the same time, cross the gray commissure, hop over to the right ascending tract, and then head up to the brain with that information. So polysynaptics are still fast, but you know, we can notify the brain by this more complex pathway that we're using. So on your worksheet there, types of polysynaptics, well, the withdrawal reflex, the very bottom, is another name for a flexor reflex. That is the type of reflex your body uses when you do what?
Jerk
away, right? Touch a hot stove, you jerk away. You stub your toe, you jerk your leg away. So any pain source, your response is to bend and jerk your body part away. So flexor or withdrawal reflexes are those stubbing your toe, burning your hand on a hot stove, those kinds of reflexes. Tendon reflexes, I do want to tell you about that one. You're going to find this one's going to be familiar. You know, back when we talked about muscles, and we used the example of carrying a heavy box when you're moving, we turn on more motor units to carry that heavy box. But if that box was insanely heavy and you're not used to carrying that type of load, there's another reflex that's going to kick in and say, hey, drop the box. It's a polysynaptic reflex, and it's called a tendon reflex. So what are we trying to avoid doing to those tendons? Tearing them and stretching them, right? Because if you tear a tendon, what type of tissue makes it up? Connective. And it's a dense, regular connective tissue that does not like to heal. And if you tear it, you've got big business, right? You've got a big problem there with repairing that torn tendon. So yeah, if you carry something really heavy, you're probably going to drop it because you want to avoid tearing those tendons. So that's what a tendon reflex is. It's going to be kicked in when you've got a really heavy load. So it makes the muscle relax when it's being overcontracted and potentially tearing those tendons. Did you get your blanks filled in there on page? I've got 109. Some of you may have a 108. All right. Why don't we go ahead and do a little bit in the brain, which is going to be over a couple of pages. Okay, so a lot of this is a rerun for us. That's a good thing because we've already been there and done that with our brain and spinal cord protections. Let me start you at the top of the page. I've got 111. Some of y'all may have 110. So we know that bone and skull protects our brains. Vertebrae, of course, protect our spinal cords. Let's take a step deeper into the underside of that bone and talk about the membranes or meninges covering the brain and spinal cord. We've talked about this already. The tough, leathery outer covering of the brain and spinal cord is what layer? Dura mater, good. And then, of course, that dura mater is going to be covering arachnoid. Arachnoid is a spider web-like layer, and underneath that we know is pia mater. So just as a way of review, from superficial to deep, the coverings on the outside of our brain, well, the tough bone protects the tough leathery dura mater. That covers over the arachnoid layer, which is a spider web-like layer. And then underneath, we have a very soft, delicate layer called the pia mater, and that covers the surface of both brain and spinal cord. So let's talk more specifically about the brain and its dura mater. In this picture here, you can see the right side of the brain is being shown with dura mater. We are looking from the back side of the head. And you'll notice that there are folds of dura mater that go into these fissures of the brain. This fissure that runs between the two cerebral hemispheres, it's called a longitudinal fissure. And you'll notice in that longitudinal fissure, there's a big blood vessel laying there. And that big blood vessel is called a superior sagittal sinus. I don't want to confuse you and make you think that a sinus is always going to be the things here that have snot in them. There are other sinuses. These sinuses are actually big blood vessels. In fact, they're veins. Okay, so we do have sinuses or vessels that lay in these folds. And this fold here across the back goes into another fissure. This fissure is called the transverse fissure. It's running horizontally. And the set of blood vessels here are again sinuses, like the transverse sinus. It's found in that fold. So these folds I can best describe to you as being wedgies. The dura mater forms a wedgie into each of these fissures, and the blood vessel then lays in the fissure. Okay, so think of those dura mater folds as wedgies that go into those crevices between these brain regions. This piece of brain back here down below is called the cerebellum. It is different from these two cerebral hemispheres up top. And there is also a set of fissures here between the two and another fold of dura mater down in that region too. So these big fissures or cracks on the brain have these folds of dura mater that lay in them. We've talked about the arachnoid matter. How would you recognize it? Spider web, yeah. So it is a spider web-like layer that's found on the outside of both brain and spinal cord. There is a fluid here. That fluid is called what?
Cerebrospinal.
Good, cerebrospinal fluid. You can call it CSF for short. And of course, below that is the PM matter, but let's now turn our attention to cerebrospinal fluid. Okay, so to understand and appreciate cerebrospinal fluid, I need to tell you a little bit about blood. So what do you know about the components of blood? You've got blood cells, right? And you've got red blood cells, white blood cells, platelets. What do red blood cells do?
Carry oxygen.
And white blood cells?
Fight infections.
Fight infection. Yep. And then you've got those platelets. They are clotting blood. Okay, so you've got three important cell types that need to stay in your bloodstream. They are carried in a fluid in the bloodstream called plasma. All right, so plasma is the fluid that suspends and transports those blood cells. Plasma contains a lot of water. It contains salts and solutes. It contains proteins and even hormones. Bad stuff like waste products are also transported in blood plasma. So when we get to the brain, we don't necessarily want the bad stuff to get to our brain tissue. Like if you've got a life-altering bacteria in your bloodstream, if it gets into your brain, it could kill you, right? Okay? Same thing if you've got a really bad virus, the last thing you want it to do is get into your brain tissue and infect that. So we don't necessarily want everything that's in our bloodstream to have access to our brain. We only want certain things in our bloodstream to be able to have access to our brain. Like what? What might you want to give to your brain tissue?
Oxygen.
Yeah, definitely oxygen. And got to feed it, so you give it
glucose.
Okay, so you want to give oxygen to your brain tissue and glucose and maybe some other nutrients and ions, but you don't want to give it all those bad waste products or bacteria or viruses or anything else that could cause your brain tissue harm. In fact, do you need for your brain to have access to red cells, white cells, or platelets? Don't need those either. So when you see this picture of a capillary in the brain, you're looking at a special area where we actually have some access to our brain tissue. Most parts of your brain have a blood-brain barrier, meaning what's in your blood stays in your blood and does not come in contact with your brain tissue. These special areas called choroid plexuses, not to be confused with the plexuses we just talked about, actually give your blood access to your brain. But not everything, just the good stuff, just the glucose, the oxygen, the needed nutrients and ions. So this choroid plexus here is surrounded by a specialized set of cells. They're called ependymal cells. And what do you recall about the way they work? These have cilia. So whatever you can take out of your blood that your brain may want, like glucose or oxygen, then they're immersed in these fluids that the cilia then creates a current and makes it flow through your brain. So these ependymal cells are actually helping us to circulate oxygen and glucose, the good stuff that your brain needs, in a fluid of mostly water. So ependymal cells help us circulate that cerebrospinal fluid. So let me take you back. Let's see a good picture to look at. Do you see these choroid plexuses? There's a set down here by the cerebellum. There's a set up here deep inside your brain. And those choroid plexuses are the ones that take the good stuff out of your bloodstream and put it in circulation. And then the blood just travels on through the rest of the brain. So we don't need the blood cells. We don't need the bad stuff. That all just continues on a joyride through your brain. Doesn't happen to affect your brain, thankfully. Okay, so let's travel as we would with cerebrospinal fluid through your brain tissues. All right, so on your sheet there, you'll notice that cerebrospinal fluid is formed by the ependymal cells. And I'm just going to happen to pick a set. You notice there's two here. There's a set down by your cerebellum, and there's a set of these choroid plexuses deep inside your brain here. I'm going to pick these here as our starting point, and we'll just follow the path of CSF from that starting point. I also need to tell you about these hollow cavities inside your brain. These hollow cavities are called ventricles, okay? So you can see them front view, you can see them side view. Normally when we count, we start with one, right? Not in your brain, we start with three. So there are lateral ventricles here that coil into each side of your brain. They look like horns. There's a third ventricle, and down below there's a diamond-shaped fourth ventricle. So weird, we don't count starting with one, we start counting with laterals, third ventricle between the hemispheres, and this diamond-shaped fourth ventricle down below. Okay, and so these are cavities inside your brain where cerebrospinal fluid will circulate. All right, so let's start the pathway. The pathway is actually over on page 112, or flip the page with me. So like I mentioned, we're going to pick on these choroid plexuses here that are deep inside your brain. That's where we're squeezing the blood plasma and the good stuff out for your brain tissue. And we are now sitting in the lateral ventricle region. So let me take you back over here to this picture. From those choroid plexuses, that fluid and the good stuff circulates into these lateral ventricles right here on each side of your brain. And then we travel down a bit, and we travel through this interventricular foramen. What does foramen tell us?
Hole.
Good. And interventricular means it's where?
Between
the ventricles. Good. So we can travel between the ventricles here and this interventricular foramen, and then we drift down into another ventricle called the third ventricle. All you have to do is keep coming down. We now travel through a very narrow passageway between the two hemispheres. It's called the cerebral aqueduct. Keep on traveling down. You're now traveling in an area, diamond-shaped here, called the fourth ventricle. And if you keep on drifting down, you're now going to exit the brain and head into the spinal cord, but only inside. Now you're in the central canal. Let me flip pictures. You travel inside the spinal cord all the way down to the end. You remember that filum terminale that covers the cauda equina at the end of your spinal cord? We now leave the spinal cord and we're on the outside. So now the fluids travel in the subarachnoid space all the way back up to your brain, around the outside of your brain in that subarachnoid space. And then eventually, you remember those sinuses? We get absorbed back into a dural sinus on the outside of your brain. Dural meaning in the dura mater. So we're looking at one of those sinuses like superior sagittal, transverse sinus, where we reabsorb those fluids back into the blood flow. So along the way, we've picked up waste products from the brain, and we'll reabsorb those back into the blood flow to be carried back into full-on blood circulation at the heart. So what I would encourage you to do is take a picture like this one here on the left, and then use that as your pathway for traveling through CSF circulation. So if you do the side view, you don't get the nice drop down, but on the front view there, you get the following, the pathway all the way down to the spinal cord. So we will hit this again on Thursday. I'll pick you back up with CSF flow, and then we'll talk about blood-brain barrier too.